Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 22nd of July, these are our main stories. The US accuses Chinese hackers of trying to steal coronavirus vaccine data. Health authorities say the COVID outbreak in the Americas shows no sign of slowing down. And in Ukraine, a busload of hostages is freed after the president gives in to a bizarre request. Also in this podcast, a journalist is abducted in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. And researchers say there have been fewer premature births during the COVID-19 pandemic.
This is an extremely unusual time. You could look at multiple socio-environmental factors.
The US Justice Department has charged two Chinese nationals with stealing information from companies working on coronavirus treatments. The two former engineering students are also accused of targeting defense contractors, software companies, and Chinese opposition figures over a number of years. The US indictment says the information was passed on to the Chinese government. Assistant Attorney General John Charles Demers gave more details.
The campaign targeted intellectual property and confidential business information held by the private sector, including COVID-19-related treatment, testing, and vaccines. The hackers also targeted the online accounts of non-government organizations and individual dissidents, clergy, and democratic and human rights activists in the United States, China, and Hong Kong.
Our correspondent in Washington, Barbara Platt-Usher, told me more.
The indictment says that these two alleged cyber criminals stole terabytes of data worth hundreds of millions of dollars over 10 years, and they targeted computers around the world, including the US, Britain, and some European countries, and they stole all kinds of things like trade secrets and weapons designs and software codes and so on. And most recently, according to the indictment, they had begun to target biofirms working on coronavirus vaccines.
And what do we know about these individuals? They're both Chinese nationals. What are their links to the Chinese state?
We don't know a lot about them, frankly, according to the indictment. It mentions two former engineering students, that they were criminals who stole to benefit themselves, but also, the indictment says, to benefit the Chinese government. So in terms of specifics about the links, it says that the two men worked with China's civilian spy agency, which is similar to the CIA in America or the MI6 in the UK, and that it helped the spy agency to target dissidents and human rights activists. More generally, the U.S. security officials talked about these two men being on call to feed Beijing's insatiable hunger for intellectual property, is how it was phrased. So in other words, economic espionage, something that the Chinese government routinely denies, that it hacks foreign computers for that purpose.
How common does the U.S. believe Chinese hacking is, and also vaccine hacking as the latest iteration of this?
Well, Chinese hacking, very common, the U.S. believes, especially since the stealing of intellectual property. It's an entrenched and controversial issue and has been for some time. In fact, the vast majority of federal economic espionage prosecutions in the U.S. allege benefit to the Chinese state. So they see a Chinese hand involved in most of these kinds of prosecutions. We've seen these warnings about Chinese hackers trying to get at vaccine research, of course, more recently because of the COVID epidemic and the benefits of getting their hands on a vaccine. But it's not only the Chinese. Last week, the US, Britain and Canada also warned that Russian hackers were trying to do the same.
Barbara Platt-Usher. 3 months ago, the daily White House coronavirus briefings came to an abrupt end just after President Trump made headlines around the world by suggesting disinfectant could be used to kill the virus with injections, or, as he put it, a cleaning inside the lungs. But as cases continue to soar in the US, the president is back for season two, and unlike in the past, the emphasis was on masks.
Young adults may often have mild or even no symptoms. They won't even know they're sick. They won't have any idea that they have a virus. They won't have any idea at all. America's youth will act responsibly, and we're asking everybody that when you are not able to socially distance, wear a mask, get a mask, Whether you like the mask or not, they have an impact, they'll have an effect, and we need everything we can get.
Our US correspondent Peter Bowes was watching, and I asked him what he's been saying.
The first thing to note is that he really struck a noticeably more measured tone than in some of those earlier briefings, and more measured by the fact that he seemed to be repeating a lot of the advice that we've been hearing in the last few weeks and months from his health experts and the doctors that have been advising him, like wear a mask, something that the president clearly has been reluctant to do. We have now seen him visiting a hospital wearing a mask, but he didn't embrace the use of masks particularly enthusiastically. He does appear now to be on board with the messages that masks can help to slow the spread of the virus. It can protect other people if you are infected, and maybe to a lesser extent the opposite situation. He's advising people to wash their hands, to shelter at-risk populations, extra vigilance applied to nursing homes. And he repeated his often heard view, at least in the last few days, that as far as fatalities in this country, in the United States, he believes the US is faring much better than the most other countries in the world. But he did acknowledge that things are going to get worse before they get better. And he referred to the fact that there has been an upsurge in cases in what's known as the Sun Belt, those southern and western states, California, Texas, Florida, Arizona, that really have seen a spike in the last few days.
Peter Bowes. With more than 7.5 million cases, the Americas count for more than half the global infections, and the pandemic is still spreading. That's the warning from the head of the Pan American Health Organization. Carissa Etienne says at the current rate, almost a third of the population is at risk of complications.
The COVID-19 pandemic is showing no signs of slowing down in our region. During the last week, there were almost 900,000 new cases and nearly 22,000 deaths reported in our region, most of these within Brazil, Mexico, and the United States of America.
Our America's editor, Candace Peart, has more details.
Carissa Etienne was very clear. She said there's surges of cases going on in Bolivia, in Ecuador, Colombia and Peru, and that this pandemic is now spreading, particularly it's arrived in the northeastern coast of the continent, in the Guyanas, and the Central American countries are now seeing higher weekly increases since when the virus arrived. Now, she says that she's particularly concerned because of the vulnerability of the populations in the Americas. They bear a big burden of poverty, of infectious diseases and chronic conditions. And so this is leaving 3 out of 10 people at risk, she says, of developing COVID complications. That's over 300 million people.
Are these warnings having any effect on the response to the pandemic?
Well, she says there's been some bright spots. She said in Chile and Uruguay and Argentina, they've been making important progress in strengthening surveillance and introducing COVID prevention measures like hand washing and social distancing. She says in the Caribbean, they've implemented effective travel restrictions to control the outbreaks and are now able to resume non-essential travel. But it's clear she's warning most governments that they must do more to organize a concerted response. Now, she's talking at a time when many countries in the region have begun loosening their lockdowns despite these high numbers of cases and the growing death toll.
And very briefly, Candace, Brazil the hardest hit, but the government there now focusing on vaccines.
That's right. Brazil definitely gambling on gaining access to a successful vaccine as soon as possible, perhaps since it hasn't managed to establish a working track and trace programs and a testing regime across the country. So it's approved 3 clinical trials now for vaccines.
Candace Peart. Police in western Ukraine have freed a group of about a dozen hostages who were being held on a bus by a heavily armed man. All are said to be uninjured. And it was a strange turn of events that brought this standoff to a peaceful end. Jonah Fisher reports from Kiev.
It lasted about 12 hours in all. This morning, Maxim Krivosh, a 44-year-old, a Ukrainian born in Russia, boarded this bus and took all the people on board hostage. And basically, we've had a siege situation in the center of this western Ukrainian town of Lutsk, whereby snipers and armed police have surrounded it, and they've been negotiating with Mr. Krivosh inside the bus. Now, there has just been, well, I have to say, quite frankly, a mind-bendingly surreal conclusion to it, because in the demands that were put out by Mr. Krivosh on social media, he made some pretty wacky demands, you have to say, really, about senior Ukrainian figures posting things to YouTube in which they called themselves terrorists and various other things. And perhaps strangest of all was his demand that Ukraine's president, the former comedian Volodymyr Zelensky, should publicly encourage people to watch a particular Hollywood film, a film from 15 years ago called Earthlings, a documentary about animal rights and how animals were being treated in the modern world. At the time, everyone shrugged their shoulders and just thought, this is crazy. But then a six-second video popped up on President Zelensky's feed, and a video in which he says, a 2005 film, Earthlings, everybody should watch it. So effectively, he complied with what this gunman had wanted to do on board that bus. And within about an hour or so of that being made public on President Zelensky's Facebook page, the gunman was out of the bus. He'd put his gun on the ground, he'd been detained, and the hostages had all walked free. So a pretty strange end to what for some period of time had been quite a scary day in Lutsk, where it looked like, you know, there were certainly bullets flying around. It looked like there could potentially be a very, very serious conclusion.
Jonah Fisher. It's difficult to know just how far the coronavirus has spread through Africa. Most of its countries have performed only a fraction of the tests carried out in the UK, the US and European nations. But we do know that the number of infections is now rising rapidly in some regions, including South Africa, which already has the world's fifth largest outbreak. Our correspondent Andrew Harding in Johannesburg took a look at the picture across Africa.
For the longest time, it seemed tantalisingly possible that this continent might be spared the worst. Strict lockdowns held fast, hospitals stood empty, and musicians urged Africans to keep their guard up. The coronavirus is sweeping over mankind. Everybody must be alert. It's a club of... But today, here in South Africa, the dam has burst.
The coronavirus storm is far fiercer and much more destructive than any that we have known before.
President Cyril Ramaphosa warning of the struggles ahead.
It is stretching our resources as we speak, but it is also stretching our resolve.
True, but some parts of South Africa are coping impressively well. The death rate here is well below European levels so far.
The treatment that I've got from there, that was tremendous. Look at me right now. I am a survivor.
In other regions, though, the virus is ruthlessly exposing institutional rot.
Limited bed capacity, limited staff. Services are starting to crumble under the strain.
And now the rest of the continent, with far weaker health systems than South Africa, is waiting its turn.
I never felt unsafe on the whole trip.
And I will tell all the people at home how safe it is here.
Some countries like Tanzania are controversially playing down the risks and focusing Trump-style on opening up their fragile economies, not least for tourism.
Come to Tanzania.
Tanzania is safe. Tanzania unforgettable.
Others, like the war-torn, impoverished Central African Republic, are feeling decidedly neglected and nervous. Health Minister Pierre Somze warning that the whole country can only handle about 100 COVID tests a day.
We are really experiencing a real challenge in accessing supplies. So while we are all talking about global solidarity, this is not being experienced really by people in the Central African Republic.
That issue of solidarity is crucial. China and the US have both boasted about helping Africa during the pandemic. But the reality, according to David Miliband, who runs a global humanitarian charity, the IRC, is that it's every nation for itself.
The truth is that Africa is helping itself more than anyone else is helping Africa. But it's also the case that there are significant parts of the continent that are going to need outside help.
But it's also worth noting that for much of Africa, COVID-19 is not yet, the all-consuming threat that it is elsewhere. As the World Health Organization points out, this continent is still consumed by other battles against poverty, against other deadly viruses, and against insecurity. And so, for instance, Ethiopia is wrestling with violent protests, Zimbabwe is sinking into a hyperinflationary spiral, and in Mali, unmasked crowds have been demonstrating against government corruption and a deadly Islamist insurgency. Threats that all feel far more urgent right now than yet another virus.
Andrew Harding. Still to come in this podcast, doctors in Serbia say the country's response to COVID-19 has been a public health disaster. And Italy's smallest village celebrates the arrival of its first baby in 8 years. Human rights groups have expressed concern for a prominent Pakistani journalist who they say has been abducted in the capital, Islamabad. Sukunda Kamani is there.
Matiola Jan is a well-known journalist who at times has been critical of Pakistan's powerful military and the current government led by Imran Khan. He had recently been issued with a contempt of court notice for one of his tweets. Video captured on security cameras appears to show him being bundled into a car by around a dozen men, some of whom are in black uniform. However, his family have not been notified of his arrest, and local police say they were not involved. Press freedom campaigners say the space for dissent in Pakistan has been shrinking over the past few years.
Sukunda Kamani. With the number of coronavirus infections rising in Austria, the government has reintroduced rules making face coverings mandatory in supermarkets, banks and post offices. This comes just 3 weeks after those same restrictions were lifted. The Austrian Chancellor, Sebastian Kurz, told a news conference the measures would take effect on Friday.
On the one hand, this is to protect people who have to go to those places. And on the other hand, it's because we know the mask has a symbolic effect. The more it disappears from our everyday life, the more we forget about any concerns.
Face masks have remained obligatory on public transport, in hospitals and pharmacies and at hairdressers. Coronavirus outbreaks are also growing in the Balkan region. And in Serbia, hundreds of doctors have called for officials leading the response to be sacked. In a letter to the Serbian government, the physicians said the work of the officials had been a public health disaster, particularly in the weeks leading up to parliamentary elections last month. Guy Delaunay reports from Belgrade.
More than 350 doctors signed the letter. They accused Serbia's coronavirus crisis staff of putting politics over expertise by allowing public events to go ahead before the election. Crowds at football matches, tennis tournaments and nightclubs led to a loss of control over the epidemiological situation, they say. The doctors also want an independent investigation into whether the authorities have concealed the true number of infections and deaths from COVID-19. Serbia's coronavirus infection rate has increased significantly since the election and the government has reintroduced many restrictions.
Guy Delaunay in Belgrade. One rare bright spot during the coronavirus pandemic has been a significant drop in premature births, noted in multiple studies from around the world. Professor Roy Phillip is a neonatalist at University Hospital in Limerick, Ireland, who led one of those studies. My colleague Tim Franks asked him why this is happening.
I have to admit, we don't know the precise reason. We could only hypothesize or postulate. What we thought is this is an extremely unusual time, the COVID lockdown. So, for example, women were at home. They were perhaps taking more rest, better sleep, less work-related stress particularly, way less of commuting because nobody was traveling. And very important, their partners also were either at home or working from home. Way better environmental pollution situation, better nutrition, other small children who were going to creche or play school perhaps were not bringing home infections, less smoking. I mean, you could look at multiple such socio-environmental factors.
It's all incredibly plausible. It's also presumably very frustrating that, as you say, there's really no way to establish a firm causal link, is there?
I would say at the moment we can only say an association and not a causation. The value is going to come when many other centers are going to study this together. And then we look at the differences in the lockdown measures in different countries, population characteristics, how actually each of the population took up the lockdown on themselves. Supportive measures, financial support. I think there's a lot of things to be done before we pinpoint a causation.
Professor Roy Philip from Limerick's University Hospital. Well, the birth of a child is always a happy event, but in the Italian village of Mortrone, there's a special reason to celebrate. It's the first time a family there has had a baby for 8 years. Mortrone is Italy's smallest village. And our reporter, Jonathan Savage, told us all about it.
His name is Dennis, and he was born on Sunday weighing 2.6 kilograms. So Dennis brings the population of Mortrone up to 29. In the words of the mayor, it truly is a celebration for the whole community, except, of course, she said it in Italian. Now, of course, no one is celebrating more than his mum and dad, Matteo and Sara. On the door of their house is a blue ribbon. That's the traditional Italian notification of the birth of a boy. It was 2012 when a ribbon was last seen on a Mortrone front door. It was a pink one back then. And as you'd expect, a big village party is being planned.
What this really brings into focus, though, Jonathan, is rural Italy's population problem.
Italy in general, Alex, to be fair. Just a few weeks ago, data was published showing that Italy's birth rate hit a record low last year. 420,170 babies were born. That's the lowest number since records began in 1861. And what that means is that Italy's population of Italian citizens is now 55 million, and it hasn't been that low for almost a century. A drop of 677,000 in just 4 years in the middle of the last decade. So the lack of little Dennises, a decrease in birth, is a big factor. Plus, tens of thousands of people of working age leaving the country to find jobs. Out in rural areas like Mortrone, 1 in 7 inhabitants have moved to towns and cities in the last quarter century. So thousands of villages are becoming ghostly and millions of homes are left uninhabited.
Choosing your words carefully, what's being done to alleviate it?
Yes, well, some say the main focus has to be on growing industries that could support a population. Agriculture, tourism, for example. Most tourists tend to go to a few rural areas in Tuscany, Sardinia and Umbria. There are more local creative schemes, such as selling empty houses for an effective pittance on the proviso that a greater sum of money is invested renovating the buildings. In northern Italy, a village even offered a $2,000 lump sum to settlers, but then they later retracted that offer. And famously, there was the village of Riace. In 2018, the mayor was banished following accusations he organised marriages of convenience for immigrants. That court order put Domenico Lucano in the unusual position of being mayor of a town he was forbidden to step foot in. So the population there decreased by one as well.
Okay, so briefly back to the village of Mortrone. It is a tiny village though, isn't it? What, one bigger today, but still very, very small.
Yeah, 29 is the population. It's up in the mountainous Lombardy region. And I mentioned the mayor of the area. Her name is Antonella Invernizzi. She's the mayor of Mortrone. She was the one saying it was a celebration for the whole community. The reason the population was 28 was because her father died recently. And it's poignant to hear that she's the mayor celebrating the birth of this baby.
Jonathan Savage. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.